we're back after that delightful tea break. And continuing our trip through London's history, we find ourselves at the rather famous date, 1066.
Oh my God, it's here.
It's here already. Can you believe it? Now, if you were educated in this country, then your post-Roman history of London probably fast-forwarded to here, and you'll know some of the key plot points. The Norman invasion, the Battle of Hastings, the arrow in the eye, the Normans conquer.
And I think it's probably useful to have a quick digression on who the Normans were.
Remember we mentioned how the Vikings got about?
I do.
Well, the Normans are another branch of Viking. These ones raided and settled in northern France, Norsemen, hence Normandy. And they were a pretty fierce bunch of folk, famed for their skills in war.
How terrifying.
So perhaps it's not that surprising that when William, Duke of Normandy, brought his Normans over to pursue his fairly tenuous claim to the English throne, he was really quite successful. He conquered and was crowned in London in Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day 1066.
How appropriate.
Tell us about the Normans' London legacy.
Okay, well, one of their significant faves were castles. They built a lot of them.
You hear a lot about a Norman castle, don't you? All across Britain.
Yeah, absolutely. As an army in Britain, or a conquering army in Britain, they had to build a number of castles in order to cement their place in their new kingdom. And a few of the famous ones include Windsor Castle and the White Tower of the Tower of London.
So the Tower of London, the tower itself, is almost 1,000 years old.
Yes.
Madness.
Yeah. Built just a little while after the Norman conquest.
Funny that.
20 years or so, I think. They built it as their London castle.
Along with a couple of others that have since vanished, I believe.
Yes, but still many survived. They were a sturdy, sturdy construction, most of them. And they are, as you say, all across the country. The other big thing that the Normans did was a survey of Britain. And you may have heard of it. It was called the Domesday Book.
Remind me what that is again. It's one of those things you know, but you don't know, you know, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Comes up in history at school and then you forget about it. Basically, when William the Conqueror conquered England, he wanted to find out more about what he'd got his hands on. And so he sent his officers out across the kingdom and had them find out from the various landowners what they owed him in taxes.
So it's basically the first ever census.
Yeah, similar to a census, but with a bit more focus on how much he could extract from people. Although you could have your own views on what the census is all about. So he went out into the land, found out from them. And the really useful thing for us about the Domesday Book is that it gives us the first detailed, or some of the first detailed written records about places in England, their names, the things that they had, whether it was head of cattle or area of land. And I say detail with a bit of a loose term, but this is the first time a lot of that stuff gets written down.
It's basically the first time where we come across, there's a written record of names that we recognise in London.
Yeah, this is there. This is often the record harks back to the Domesday Book when you're looking for places and their history.
Let's move a little bit further down the poor medieval road to a period that was characterized by plagues and revolt.
Sounds fun.
During this period, outbreaks of plague were really very common in the highly unsanitary conditions of medieval Europe. There was a lack of awareness of the cause of a plague. People had no idea, really. I mean, most contemporary theories focused on the heavens being the cause of this plague sent down. We know now it was caused because of fleas on rats coming in.
Yeah.
Another invasion, if you will, another conquest, a conquest of plague. So in 1348 AD, there was a major outbreak of bubonic plague in London, which became known as the Black Death. I mean, it was Europe-wide, but London got hit very hard. And it killed between a third and a half of London's population.
Which is a very broad
scope. I'm not laughing because of the sad amount of Londoners that were killed. I'm laughing at the fact that...
It's to do with that very broad metric, isn't it? Mm. That's fair. And I suppose noteworthy is that the Black Death, famous moment as it is in London's history, kicks off something called the Second Plague Pandemic, for England anyway, which would last in Europe for the next 300 years.
Wow. Well, we thought we had it bad.
Yeah, puts pandemics in perspective, doesn't it?
It does. And despite the ravages of the Black Death, London actually returned to growth economically and politically fantastically well.
As it does, eh?
As it does. We'll see this come up time and time again. In this period, we see the emergence of commercial entities known as guilds. These guilds basically run the city of London, looking out for its commercial interests. It's gold, fish, stonemasonry, we're all guilds. And they elected their own leader to represent their interests, known as the Lord Mayor of London. That's the first time we see it.
Ah, yeah. Dick Whittington.
Yes, who was Lord Mayor three times.
Yeah.
With his cat.
Fitzalwin de Londonstone.
One of your faves.
Yeah, well, it's fun because he put Londonstone in his name because he thought it would be important. We're going to talk about the Londonstone?
Well, you know, famously, the Londonstone is apparently put there by Brutus of Troy, so we can go there again if you want.
You know what? Let's leave the Londonstone where it is.
We think that the Londonstone was probably a remnant of Roman London. But...
Cannon Street, I think. All right, let's move on. The Black Death was, as we've already said, quite a significant moment in the history of London. And it made existence in what was already a pretty grim period for the average person much harder. When the king decided to levy a new poll tax to fund wars he was having in France, right in the wake of all of this, things kind of kicked off.
I'd be angry.
I think you would. You know, shit's hard enough without this new poll tax, King.
Yes, King Richard the Second.
Yeah, it's just a cheap move. It's a low blow.
It is.
It's a low blow. So in 1381, after that poll tax is levied, we get the Peasants' Revolt, which you've probably heard of.
Maybe.
The Peasants' Revolt is significant because it's the first popular uprising in British history. And by popular, we mean loads of people got involved, as opposed to just a few. Wat Tyler was the leader, and his supporters demanded a few things. Now, they demanded that all men should be free and equal, and there should be a fairer distribution of wealth. And
so it's basically an early social justice movement.
Yeah, you could say that. Very early embryonic stages, they wouldn't have known what they were doing as social justice, but it was, absolutely.
It's quite misleading to call it the Peasants' Revolt, even though that's how it's known, because these men, because they were men, earning the money at the time, were taxpayers. Yeah. They weren't exactly peasants.
Peasants, I know. Well, not in our modern sense of what a peasant is.
But I guess the populace got behind their cause.
Yeah, I think the idea is supposed to suggest it wasn't lords, right?
Yes,
it was
bishops.
It was
and
other
all those
people.
Guys, yeah.
It was the average guys. Mm-hmm. So those unfortunately all get lumped in and called peasants, which is a bit unfair. Anyway, as you say, it's a social justice movement in its very early embryonic phases, and they march on London.
What happened when they got there?
I'll tell you about it, bro. They coordinated attacks on crown targets. Sacking the Savoy Palace was one significant one. And the city's jails. They even managed to get into the tower.
So the Normans, even though they built a lot of castles, made them easy to get into.
That's not fair. I think it was probably a pretty concerted effort that they mounted to get into the tower. But once they got in there, they caused all kinds of hell. They hunted down the archbishop and the king's treasurer and lopped off their heads. And what did they do next?
I believe they paraded the heads around the city all the way to Westminster before mounting them very tastefully in frames on London Bridge, on spikes.
Probably with some flowers and maybe
garlands.
A Roman candle. Mm. Yeah.
See these bleeding heads.
Pretty dramatic. I mean, pretty grisly.
They clearly wanted to make a point.
They did, yeah. And despite them managing to make these advances, the revolt was eventually defeated. people who had taken part, certainly the ringleaders, were rounded up, killed, probably paraded as well. But the demands that they'd made, less harsh laws, money for the poor, freedom, level of equality, these would all become quite in vogue later in history. So we should doff our hats to the peasants and their views.
Not technically peasants, but you know.
Not peasants, the craftsmen. So the peasant revolt passes and we have another outbreak of plague at the beginning of the 15th century.
Like we said, this era is characterized by plague and revolt, and we see plague and revolt and revolt and plague switching up all over the place. It was what happened. So we digress on a particularly grisly chapter in London's history. But, you know, this was the age of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Mm. And if you've ever read any of them, you'll know that it was a truly grim time.
Yeah, they're pretty real.
As a little side note, did you know that Geoffrey Chaucer lived in Aldgate, in the actual gate above it?
No way. I didn't.
So he saw the coming and going of Londoners on a regular basis.
God, that's a bit of a funny place to live.
Bizarre, isn't it? It's quite hard to fathom considering none of the old gate exists anymore.
Yeah, I imagine they were probably quite grand, the rooms in the gates.
Perhaps. I've seen a mock-up of what it might have been like. It's like double arch.
It wasn't fancy, was it?
Well, you just don't associate Chaucer with grandiosity, do you?
Like, no,
he was he was quite
More of a wooden stool than a...
Yeah, and like shit stains and stuff. Like he was quite...
He was shit stains. That's absolutely correct.
If Paul Bettany's performance in A Knight's Tale is anything to go by, yeah. Which I think is fantastic.
That's probably the iconic Chaucer for most people.
Moving on from Geoffrey Chaucer.
And the whole period, in fact.
And the period. Yeah. We alight on Tudor London. Characterized by those white buildings with the wooden beams going through them. That's a Tudor building.
Yeah. Timber beams. Buildings.
And we segue into the early 16th century and the reign of Henry VIII, which began in 1509.
Hey, I know that guy.
You do. Rotund.
Yeah, famously.
One of Henry's famous moves was parting ways with the Catholic Church and installing himself as the head of the Church of England, which became known as the Dissolution of the Monasteries. Also, he could divorce his wife.
I mean, that's not the official reason.
It's not the official reason, but...
He put a lot of time and effort into making it clear that it was a theological issue that he had to address.
So how do you explain away the six wives?
Obviously, he liked wives.
And theology.
And theology all at the same time. And hated the Pope, probably.
Whatever the truth of the matter, this did lead to the dissolution of the monasteries.
It amounted to the dissolution of the monasteries, yeah.
Now, the effect that this has on London is as follows. London at this time was very much a city of spires.
That's a beautiful phrase, Ollie.
Thank you very much. I like it myself. I think of it as spires and smoke.
Ah, yes, very atmospheric.
With the silver stream.
All right,
of Oscar.
Come on, let's pick it up.
It was crisscrossed by a prominent network of churches, of monasteries, convents,
friaries.
Friaries, indeed. The White Friars and the Black Friars.
Ah, we'll come on to that.
And Henry basically said, all of this is now mine. And so they were turned to new uses, or they were simply demolished. So London would have lost a lot of fabulous...
venerable institutions.
Exactly.
That have been there for hundreds of years.
Indeed. And it was a clear symbolic rejection of papal authority in the capital. As with the whole nation, the city's character was changed forever by this episode in its history.
Yeah, you mentioned the Blackfriars there, and it's a fun little tidbit, so let's drop it in. One of the friaries that Henry got rid of with his dissolution of the monasteries was the Dominican friary at Blackfriars. It was called that because they used to wear black robes, the Dominican friars. Hmm. And so that area had the nickname, the area name, Blackfriars. They'd been based there for hundreds of years, but like everybody else, they got booted out. So eventually Blackfriars was repurposed from its original use as a monastery, and it would play host to a new, rather significant cultural form that began sweeping London, namely the playhouse. This one's all you, bro.
playhouse. Okay, so I'm clearly an expert on this. I'm really not. The playhouse. We're in 1570s and we're still in the second plague pandemic.
Oh my God, still?
For those of you keeping up. And so the City of London banned any public theatrical performances and players within the city walls because they thought that those kind of gatherings were spreading plague. So this banning resulted in a flurry of new playhouses being built all over the shop and conveniently located just outside of the city walls in places like Shoreditch, where we had the theatre, just called the theatre, like, you know, that's pretty much does what it says on the tin, the Curtain. And then in Southwark, you had the Globe, which some of us will recognise, and the Rose. And so this is very much Shakespeare's London. It's dotted with playhouses and regularly shuttered on account of this bloody great plague that's still going on.
Yeah.
Mass gatherings banned, playhouses, brothels, bear baiting arenas were all closed.
What?
The
bear baiting arenas? I know. That doesn't seem fair.
Close the pubs, close the theatres.
But not my bear baiting arena.
Leave me my bear baiting.
I feel like you could play that sport at a distance.
I know, we could bait bears wherever we are.
It might just be the crowds, the baying crowds.
And another major outbreak in 1603 is believed to have killed around 30,000 Londoners out of a population of 200,000.
All right, so a couple of years later, after your really serious outbreak in 1605, we get the gunpowder plot. Recognize this?
I do recognize that.
Yeah. So, do you know who the main agitator was?
Guy Fawkes.
Wrong.
Oh.
I knew you'd do that. You stepped right into it. In fact, the gunpowder plot was headed up by a guy called Robert Catesby. He had a number of co-conspirators, one of which was Guy Fawkes. He was rather unfortunate to get fingered for the whole thing,
though. So he was just a fool guy.
He was literally the fool guy. The idea that they had, or they were plotting, was the assassination of the new king and his government by blowing up the Houses of Parliament, iconically. Their hope was that they could restore a Catholic monarchy. This is to do with the legacy of issues around us turning into a Protestant country suddenly. And while that never came to fruition, Guy Fawkes did get busted hard underneath the House of Parliament with loads of barrels of gunpowder.
So it's kind of like an early terrorist incident?
Yeah.
Extremism, exactly.
It's an extreme move.
It was an extreme
move.
To try
and blow up the Houses of Parliament. Yeah, you could call it that, absolutely. London would get used to those, wouldn't they?
And boy, we don't forget it, do we?
No, we don't.
We remember that near miss of the Houses of Parliament and, of course, the King.
Yes.
Every year.
Yeah, you got to feel bad for Guy Fawkes, though. I mean, burning effigies every year is... feels a bit excessive after 500
I mean, is it worth it? I mean, if he could see it now, you know, arguably one of the most famous villains in London lore.
Yeah.
But certainly in British history.
Wicked mask as well.
Yes, the Vendetta thing.
Yeah.
Onions.
So one king that didn't get quite as lucky as the king who avoided the gunpowder plot... Charles I. He was the king during the English Civil War.
Okay, the English Civil War. What was that about?
Let's do it quickly. Basically, it was fought over who really was the main governing force, the crown or parliament. With a bit of a sideline in religious freedom and how you should worship. Oliver Cromwell is the leader of the parliamentarians, though, the people who leads parliament, and they win after all of it.
What's London's attitude to all that?
You might not be surprised to learn that London was behind parliament, woke bunch that they were.
Mm.
The king stood for old values, divine right, don't mess with
tradition,
monarchy, and the parliamentarians being an elected body... or the parliament being elected body, said, we have the right as an elected group to rule by the people's consent, and you stand in the way of that. And so it kicked off. While London is a majority supporter of parliament as a theatre of the war, it's not very significant. Most of the action happens up country. And when Charles gets beheaded, thousands of Londoners turn out to see him get his head lopped off at Whitehall.
Outside Inigo Jones's banqueting house.
Outside, yes, that beautiful, beautiful building. He's the only English monarch to whom this ever happened.
That's far. Sorry, I'm just saying it.
Yeah, stuff's weird these days. But one of the famous Londoners who went and saw it happen, the head chopping off, was Samuel Pepys.
Iconic Londoner.
Iconic guy.
Right. The diarist.
Always shout outs to Samuel Pepys. So he was a Cromwell supporter and a Republican, as his diary tells us. So Pepys witnesses the execution and writes about it in his diary on the 13th of October, 1660. And he comes across pretty casual, to be honest. He tells us about how he saw the execution. Very little other detail. Went to the pub with his mates, had some oysters, and then took a water taxi home and had a Barney with his wife.
Just another day in the life of Samuel Pepys.
The goddamn Peep.
So welcome to London in the 1660s. And we are in for one hell of a decade, Londoners. As a Londoner, you've witnessed a king being executed. You've survived a civil war, presumably. Seen your country become a republic. And then see your country reinstate the monarchy, albeit with some new constitutional limitations. At this point, you might be hoping for some let-up. Mm-hmm. No. However, sanitation is still non-existent in the city, and it's bursting at the seams population-wise. Within the city, there's overcrowded, tightly packed housing, overused roadways, bottlenecks at the city gates constantly. Sounds beyond the city walls, overspill suburbs known as liberties start cropping up. Areas like Hatton Garden, the Tower and beyond, and Southwark. And so London at this time was a powder keg.
It certainly sounds like it.
I mean, I can. It's quite easy to imagine this packed and congested and smelly London.
I think it's basically what smelly museums were invented for.
Pretty much. And in the summer of 1665 comes not just any old plague, but the Great Plague. The outbreak took hold as flea populations exploded in the warm summer months.
So with this Great Plague, you'd have a pretty hard time. When anyone first kind of sensed there was any infection in a person, they'd be slammed in their house, sealed in, and they'd have a red cross painted on their door along with the words, "Lord have mercy upon us," I guess in the words of the person inside as opposed to anyone else, which is ironic. That's about as scientific as it got back then. Shut them indoors and stay away, and also hope that the Lord saves them. So we had some travel restrictions as well.
No, we didn't.
Yes, we did. They go back that far. Let me tell you about them. Ships arriving from known plague centres in Europe, where, of course, this was also going on.
Plague was still raging.
Yeah. Were required to dock at Canvey Island, which is in the Thames estuary, for a period of 30 days. Now, that was called a trentine, which comes from an Italian word. In 1664, as things in Europe got worse, the authorities said that the isolation period on Canvey Island had to be increased to 40 days, which they called, can you guess?
Quarantine.
Yes.
Wow, that's where we get it from.
That's where we get it from. So that was the story of the plague, the Great Plague. London lost around 100,000 souls to this one, which was at the time, it was about a quarter of the population. Pepys wrote rather somberly, "Lord, how empty the streets are, and how melancholy." I'm sure we can all associate with that.
It's deep. And the 1660s were not done with London. Oh no, they were not. Because no sooner had the plague subsided than on the night of Sunday, the 2nd of September, 1666, might be the giveaway.
No, that one.
A fire started in Pudding Lane on the north bank of London Bridge. There'd been a terrible drought that summer. And so as a result, you know what a terrible drought is like.
Yeah, shit gets tinder dry.
Things get dry. And combined with some unfortunately strong winds and some rather annoyingly placed warehouses full of fuel, the fire swiftly grew out of control, and by the morning, the entire riverfront surrounding London Bridge was ablaze.
And we knew that this wasn't going to go well. On Monday, the fire spread north from the river, and in the night, fires coming from three different directions down three different roads converged on the junction of Cheapside, Threadneedle Street and Cornhill.
To make a super fire.
Essentially, yeah. Mm. This is the point where we now have Bank Station, where the Royal Exchange is.
So that's where the fires met.
That's where the fires met and where the super fire was formed. It then moved down Cheapside, west to St. Paul's, which was conveniently covered in wooden scaffolding.
You'd be forgiven for thinking that someone was against you with all these things
you
going
would.
On.
The 666, the wooden scaffolding all over.
Was the 666 already the number of the devil previous year?
Yeah, it was a biblical thing. So they were like...
Well, they probably knew it was coming then.
They banked on it.
at the bank, at the side of the superfire.
Yeah. So the scaffolding around St. Paul's gave the fire a wonderful framework upon which to burn it to the ground, and we lost St. Paul's, gone, and its massive old spire. It used to be about 120 metres high, didn't you know?
So we went from a spire to a dome.
We did, yeah. Next it went down Fleet Street, so continued west, and was eventually, thank God, stopped at Temple, to the west and to the north at Smithfields on the Wednesday, which, given it started on a Sunday, is pretty impressive. By the Thursday, it was finally extinguished.
So it burned for 5 days in total, and it consumed 70% of the city. 100,000 people, basically the entire population of the city, were evacuated, and the majority of them were left homeless. And there are loads of first-hand accounts. Peeps writes about it a lot, of the fire. But this one from diarist John Evelyn, written on the day after the fire was extinguished, is pretty haunting. I went this morning on foot from Whitehall as far as London Bridge through the late Fleet Street with extraordinary difficulty, clambering over mountains of yet smoking rubbish and frequently mistaking where I was. The ground under my feet so hot as made me not only sweat, but even burnt the soles of my shoes and put me all over in sweat.
Oh, wow. So what, he sweat was, twice?
What he's trying to say is, sweat just want to make you sweat.
But he got hot and it made him sweat.
Yeah.
You can understand that.
Yeah, no shit. There'd just been the biggest fire in London's history.
It must have been still very, very hot.
This is one of the most significant chapters in London's history. Of course he sweat.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm parched.
Yeah.
Cuppa?
Let's do it.